Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. It's been a while since we've caught up with my friend and comrade in arms, our colleague at the Center for Security Policy, who directs the Mideast program there, Dr. David Wormser. In fact, when last we spoke with him, he was forward deployed in the state of Israel, as he had been, since before the invasion of October 7th, and then for several weeks thereafter. And we were the great beneficiary of his on-the-ground reporting and insights into what was going on. It's high time that we caught up with him. He's back in the States safely, happily, and nonetheless still keeping a very close eye on what is developing there. And David, I'm always glad to see you. You bring a wealth of expertise to our conversations in terms of your time serving as a naval intelligence officer, rising to the rank of lieutenant commander in the Navy, as well as in senior positions at the State Department, the National Security Council, and with the Vice President of the United States and several administrations. I'm glad to have you here to give us particularly kind of a reality check. We're hearing an awful lot of things about what the Israelis are doing to genocidally eliminate the Palestinians. We're hearing that the right response for America is for the Jews to be driven from the river to the sea, and so much more that is, frankly, an affront to our intelligence, but nonetheless is getting a lot of currency and seemingly feeding into this idea. The Biden administration is increasingly publicly espousing that there has to be protracted humanitarian pauses, if not actually a ceasefire. Level set for us, if you would.
I think the Israeli, the government, even if it had any intentions of perhaps giving in to the pressure, can't. The Israeli military, the Israeli people want to go the whole way. And as the death toll rises of Israeli soldiers, the idea that they would have been wasted and we're back to another round, that is growing as a problem. So I don't see the Israeli government ultimately bowing to genuinely bowing to pressures on these ceasefires. Where I think the pressure is a bit more concerning is in the north, in the Lebanese border. It is clear now that Israel cannot end this war with Lebanon and Hezbollah being a threat as much as, or much more so than Hamas, and the status quo returning. It has to fundamentally change the circumstances up there. It can't get there without probably a much more escalated situation. And yet the United States, still living in the world of resurrecting some deal with the Iranians and so forth, believe that a restraint and a lack of escalation in the north is the best path. So I'm afraid more for that form of pressure. The Israelis see the pressure in the west for what it is. It is Iranian networks of influence being combined with Chinese networks of influence and Chinese instruments of influence like TikTok are creating this image of a popular upheaval in the west that is going to overpower the governments to come around to the revolutionary view that they have. And the some governments are vulnerable, like the Biden administration, because they do still believe that they rely on their progressive camp for political survival. So they're trying to weave between the more traditional American view toward Israel and this progressive attack on America. And so that's where you're getting the Biden administration falling off the wagon again and again.
But I wanted to say, in addition to the Iranian networks and the Chinese Communist Party operations here, there's also the Muslim Brotherhood,
yes,
infrastructure and influence operations. Quite a number of its representatives now populate, as you know, David, the Biden administration. So that's a factor, I think, in all of this as well. And I just wonder, to the extent that the administration's principal leverage seems to be whether they will continue to provide resupply of arms to Israel. is, you know, a lever that they are prepared to exploit to compel Israel to change course, is kind of the multi-billion dollar question, is it not?
It is, and I think that there are rumors still out there. I haven't seen them denied, really, that Israel is being denied at this point the bunker buster bombs. They were given them at the beginning, and they've used them, and they may still have quite a few left from their initial supply, but I'm hearing that they're not getting more, but I'm not, that has to be confirmed, but I'm hearing it. Yeah, I mean, the supply is an issue. I think this in the long term will cause Israel to return to its traditional policy of self-reliance on weapons supply. So this is going to hurt American industry in the long run, too, as the Israelis try to...
It should. The question is what happens between now and the long run. They say, in the long run, we're all dead. David, hold the thought. We'll be right back with more with Dr. David Wurmser of the Center for Security Policy. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, hundreds of thousands of us stood with Israel on the National Mall. We were treated to forceful speeches from the bipartisan congressional leadership, including this statement by the top House Democrat, Hakeem Jeffries. Quote, "Our commitment to Israel's security is ironclad. Israel has an absolute right to defend itself against Hamas terror. We must stand with Israel in its effort to decisively defeat Hamas to make sure that this brutal terrorist regime can never rise again," unquote. Welcome as they are, such commitments by Mr. Jeffries and others on Capitol Hill will amount to empty and deceptive rhetoric unless backed up by action. Most immediately, Congress must act to prevent President Biden from releasing yet another $10 billion to Iran's mullahs who fund Hamas and enabled its invasion of the Jewish state. No actual friend of Israel would fund its enemy and ours. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and we're speaking with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, who directs our Middle East program, Dr. David Wurmser, a man of considerable experience in a lot of matters, which we value highly in this particular case of what's going on in Israel at the moment, what it portends for not only the Jewish state, but for us as well. David, one thing that I wanted to ask you about, there are reports circulating. As far as I know, they've not been confirmed, but I think the Free Beacon has published something to the effect that they understand that, unbelievably, in the midst of all of this, the Biden administration is engineering yet another $10 billion infusion of cash into the Iranian mullahocracy from Iraq. Say it ain't so.
I unfortunately, the Free Beacon is a fairly credible source, so I think there's a lot of legs to this report. Whether pressure may reverse it, I don't know, but it probably will go through for the reason that it's Iraqi money that's frozen. It's Iranian money that's frozen in Iraq, and this is similar to the $6 billion that we passed through Qatar. We passed it to Qatar, and then Qatar had to release it to Iran. A week into this war, we announced that we were freezing those payments. But lo and behold, Qatar then promptly announced no, America hadn't frozen it. And in fact, the money is being transferred and will be transferred. And it was, in fact, transferred. So you may see the administration say something like, we oppose it, or something like that, but it happens. And then, because ultimately they know they have a green light. So I think the administration fundamentally believes that they have to come to terms with Iran rather than defeat the Iranian regime. And a good and the Iranians understand that, which is why you had today Zarif, the former foreign minister, out there saying, oh, he opposes any Iranian intervention in war. This is not a policy. This is manipulation of Western expectations to keep them on the wagon of diplomacy rather than resolutely, strategically stand Iran down. They're going to get their money.
Stand them down or put them out of business, as my view should be the case with the Iranian regime. David, one reason why that's so, that I think is true of Hamas, it's true of Hezbollah, it's true of the Houthi rebels, it's certainly true of the Iranian mullahs, is that baked into all of these, well, I call them Sharia supremacists, and many others operating around the world, including the Muslim Brotherhood, including here in the United States, is this idea of the triumph of Islam over not just the Jews, not just the Christians, but of the entire world. That there will ultimately be a golden age of Islam and there will be a caliphate as well. But talk a little bit about the extent to which this is not being made a part of the calculation about A, what we're up against, and B, what must be done if we're to have any real relief from it.
I've been a big advocate of Israel fighting this war alone with American diplomatic umbrella and resupply help. But ultimately, this is not Israel's fight alone. This is, you're absolutely right. This is about an Islamic ideology. It is espoused by the Iranian regime. I remember some of these quote moderates, Ali Larijani in 2006 was talking about London converting now because they'll get a better deal than when Islam triumphs and London is conquered. Then there won't be such largesse by the Muslims. You see statements by the head of Hamas saying the absolute same things, that they're not going to stop with Gaza, not stopping with the West Bank, not stopping with Israel, not stopping with the Middle East. They're going ultimately to destroy America. They make this very clear. It is inherent to their ideology. So Israel is really the front line of a global war against Islamism that has now formed an alliance, a red, green, black alliance, red being communist, or green being Islam, and black being fascism, the resurrecting fascism you see in some places. So we really see an alliance that is now quite comfortable for the moment, tactically, with the supremacist views of Sharia law and Shariaism. And that is what we're up against. And that's what, if you listen to what these people are saying in the mosques in America, and in the demonstrations in Arabic, in America, in London, in Melbourne, it is to conquer the West. The Jews are simply part of the West. The Jewish idea is part of the Western idea. You destroy the Jews, you're ultimately, it isn't about the Jews, it is about the West. And that is what they're after at the end.
And yet, the Jews are in the front, sort of echelon of this fight, and destroying them is very much part of the immediate task. David, you mentioned something important in terms of this axis of evil, I guess one might call it. On the one hand, you have obviously these Islamists of various, brands, but with those common tendencies, those common aspirations, those common convictions as to what Allah is expecting of them, which is jihad and ultimately the destruction of their enemies. There are, however, I think two other totalitarian forces at work at the moment. You mentioned one of them, the communists. The other, I don't know whether it's fascism or whether it's globalism or however else you want to describe it, but it is clearly totalitarian in character, and they are all working together, even though, amazingly, I mean, the Chinese communists, for example, are actually genocidally persecuting, by some estimates, 3 million Uyghur Muslims. How is it, David, that the Sharia supremacists seem to be so indifferent to that?
Well, we saw on the eve of World War II, we saw Hitler's Germany signing a deal with communist Russia. We saw Hitler's Germany signing a profound alliance with Japan, despite its Aryan supremacist ideologies. The truth is, these totalitarian ideologies all understand they can go nowhere, that there's absolutely no advance, progress, or hope for success until they deal with the common central threat, which is the idea of freedom in America. So they all know they have to work together first to obliterate the idea of freedom in America. Once that is done, then they can fight among themselves, and they're all confident that they'll be the ones who win against each other. But for the moment...
David Wormser, thank you for your time, my friend. I'm glad you're home, and we look forward to further collaborating with you on this side of the pond. Keep up the great work at the Center for Security Policy. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, 5 Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, 5 Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to Carrie Sloan. She is the Executive Director for Research for the Crime Prevention Research Center, founded by John Lott. She is herself a victim of domestic violence, as well as a failed justice system. Hence, she has a particular interest, both professional as well as personal, in a case that the Supreme Court took testimony on last week. And she was monitoring it, and she's here to help make sense of it for us. Carrie, thank you so much. This is a bit of a complicated matter for those of us who support gun rights, but oppose domestic violence. You know a lot about both. Walk us through both how the Supreme Court got to where it is right now and the nature of the case before it.
Well, thank you for having me. And with the Rahimi case in particular, there's a couple of interesting components a lot of people don't realize about this case. It's obviously a Second Amendment case, which is using the Bruin test to essentially decide who has a right to own a gun and who doesn't.
And the Bruin test is for laymen?
Well, it's that's it. Who gets to own a gun or who doesn't? In short. And the arguments here is the definition. What is the definition of responsible gun owners or dangerous, right? Is it arbitrary? Do we have that structured? We don't have those definitions. Interestingly enough, this case was in Texas was set on the foundation that was a domestic violence restraining order that was issued to Zaki Rahimi without representation in court. So he was actually issued a domestic violence restraining order and had his guns taken away from him without due process.
Bit of background on him and his conduct.
Interestingly enough, the only conviction in that of a very distinguished rap sheet, for better or worse, is the only conviction is being in possession of firearms while under the domestic violence restraining order. Now, let me be clear, Zaki Rahimi is in no way the best representation of gun owners in the United States. In fact, he's the one of all of them that we probably could have had. He was the last one that we could have wanted. But the reason that this case in particular means so much to me as a domestic violence survivor is the day that my abuser was arraigned, I sat in front of a female prosecutor who dropped my abuser's charges from a felony to a diversion agreement, saying that she didn't think that she could get a conviction, even though I was willing to testify against him. But more importantly and more disturbing is right after I spoke to her, I stood in front of the law enforcement officers that arrested him. Now, mind you, I am black and blue. I had fingerprints around my throat where I was picked up, thrown across the room. My teeth were broken. I hadn't eaten in days, among many other things, sexual assault. It was pretty bad. And the law enforcement officers asked me if I had a place to hide for 4 or 5 days. And I thought that was odd. And I asked them why. And they said, because the chances of violence increasing is significant and expected after he's let out of jail, because in my abuser's mind, I put him in jail, so he was angry. So even law enforcement at that point knew that my abuser was not, this restraining order was not going to keep me safe from him. But rather than telling me it's okay to defend myself or to buy a gun or any sort of self-defense, they told me to hide.
They were also at least implicitly telling you he's going to be back on the street fairly quickly.
And absolutely.
The next few days are particularly perilous for you.
Correct. And with no repercussions, really, other than this silly diversion agreement. And sure enough, he ended up becoming a stalker.
Wow. So just to put this together as best I can for our audience, they say that hard cases make bad law. And this sounds like this particular plaintiff in this case, I guess he is a pretty bad guy. He may not have been convicted on a number of charges, but he was apparently shooting at people and, otherwise wielding a weapon in a dangerous way. He had this restraining order on him because he was threatening his partner, as I understand it. So the question before the court is basically, should a guy that's this dangerous have some kind of restriction on his access to guns pursuant to a restraining order? Is that the general thrust of the matter?
For the most part, he's actually the plaintiff in this case is actually the Supreme Court. It was the Biden administration that asked the Supreme Court to hear this, not the other way around, because of the lower ruling in Zaki Brahimi's favor. That's a whole other conversation and how that whole thing went down. It was a little convoluted, but with the intention behind the lower court, I personally believe. But yes, you are correct. This is where we are. And of course, as we know, who gets to the biggest concern here is who gets to decide who's dangerous, who gets to decide who's responsible. And that's where the can of worms comes in with this particular case is, this is opening the door for the definitions of that, which can be used against good law-abiding citizens.
Yeah, in a non, domestic violence context as well. Is that really the concern for people who, revere the Second Amendment and believe it is a foundational element of our Bill of Rights and constitutional republic?
Absolutely. This is the can of worms that they are kind of set with. And in terms of which way, I'm often asked which way that I think that they're going to rule. And honestly, I can't answer that because, obviously, as someone who knows that domestic violence restraining orders don't work, I work for Crime Prevention Research Center. That's Dr. John Lott's organization that does unbiased research. We actually, on our website, I can give you the notes for that after, have the evidence showing that there is no research that supports red flag laws actually protecting victims. In fact, there is no data that says that a domestic violence restraining order prevents or reduces the number of murders of victims, whether by a gun or without a gun. So when we're talking about laws that obviously law enforcement themselves know are useless, as in my case, among countless other women that honestly will never know how many numbers, of women went through this, and even some men. But we do know that these laws can also be used against innocent people. So that's why I take the stance that I do on this issue, is that we should be enforcing the laws that are in place that are supposed to protect abuse victims, keeping these guys in jail as opposed to letting them out to reoffend when they're going to, regardless of the restraint.
That's, I guess, the crux of the matter, is are there other remedies to protect victims of domestic violence besides a restraining order that is going to be ignored and will wind up possibly harming them? So you've introduced another topic, which is obviously related, but it's also of concern, I think, to those of us who believe these rights to own and bear arms are very, very important. Red flag laws are arrangements that basically allow anybody to say, oh, that person is a potential danger, as I understand it, and set in motion a process that could very well wind up resulting in the loss of your right to bear arms. Is that the case? And how does that tie into this particular case?
Yes, and this is what this type of law is what threw me into gun rights advocacy as a domestic violence victim, knowing that these types of laws can be used against domestic violence victims. But depending on the state, depends on the broadness of arbitrary issuing of red flag laws. California, I believe it is, recently passed a law allowing family members to petition the court specifically, as opposed to having to go through law enforcement, whereas most restraining orders, they have to go through the person wanting restraining orders. Red flag laws, most people have to go through law enforcement first, and then law enforcement, goes through the courts and issues that. So Of course, the idea being able to expand the arbitrary issuing of red flag laws. Obviously, California leading that way with the, you know, allowing families to do it. But now that's going to open up the door to all kinds of people and reasons why red flag laws can be issued. But
yeah, when you say red flag laws, I think you mean red flag, you know, findings or determinations. The law is in place, presumably, but it's whether you get your gun taken away from you because somebody calls in to somebody that, you know, you're a domestic extremist or, you know, a school board parent or a traditional Catholic or something else, right?
Sure. And I apologize if I didn't articulate that. There's approximately 21 states, I believe, that have red flag laws in place. But why this Rahimi case kind of ties to this more uniquely with red flag laws is there is a federal law that says if an individual is convicted of domestic violence, then they can be permanently denied the right to bear arms. And of course, red flag laws and restraining orders both tie into that statute.
Yeah. This is a subject to which we're going to have to return. Carrie, I know that the Supreme Court will be considering this fraught matter, and we'll look forward to talking to you about how that's going as best we can tell and what decision they ultimately make. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for the work that you do at the Crime Prevention Research Center. God bless you. I'll talk to you soon. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, hundreds of thousands of us stood with Israel on the National Mall. We were treated to forceful speeches from the bipartisan congressional leadership, including this statement by the top House Democrat, Hakeem Jeffries. Quote, "Our commitment to Israel's security is ironclad. Israel has an absolute right to defend itself against Hamas terror. We must stand with Israel in its effort to decisively defeat Hamas to make sure that this brutal terrorist regime can never rise again," unquote. Welcome as they are, such commitments by Mr. Jeffries and others on Capitol Hill will amount to empty and deceptive rhetoric unless backed up by action. Most immediately, Congress must act to prevent President Biden from releasing yet another $10 billion to Iran's mullahs who fund Hamas and enabled its invasion of the Jewish state. No actual friend of Israel would fund its enemy and ours. This is Frank Affney. We're back, and it's always one of the highlights of our week to be able to say our duty genius is in the house. That would be, of course, George Raceley, Mensa Society member, so don't take my word for it. The executive editor, or editor-in-chief, I should say, of an extraordinarily important newsletter by Richard Viguerie entitled Conservative HQ. George brings to that particular position and job a wealth of experience in political life, having worked on some 300 campaigns, including at the presidential level. He's worked in the Senate, in the House, in the executive branch for the vice president, a man of considerable expertise as well as great, great judgment. We're always delighted to catch up with him. Welcome back, George.
Thank you, Frank. I'll try and live up to that buildup.
Yeah, not too much to overcome here. Let me just ask you, George, we have had a potentially very important development finally with, I guess it's not a coincidence, the departure of Kevin McCarthy from the Speaker of the House role. Mm-hmm. James Comer, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, has got a subpoena out to the Biden crime family, not the president, not the papa of the family, but Hunter, his son, James, his brother, and a fellow by the name of Rob Walker, associate of the crime family. What does this portend, do you think? And what do you make of the fact that it's happened?
This is, Representative Comer, Chairman Comer, is doing a great job of basically following the money and the email trails up the ladder to the beneficiary of all of this influence peddling. And that would be the big guy, Joe Biden himself. But so he's essentially, sort of following the path that prosecutors do when they're trying to get the boss of a mafia family. He's going after the lieutenants and looking for one of them to flip. And he's zeroed in on Rob Walker, who has been a longtime bag man for both the Clintons and the Bidens. And he's the guy who actually said in an email, basically, if they get me, we're all buried. So, that's certainly portends well. And there's, plenty of evidence that Walker was basically a smurf in their money laundering operation.
That's a technical term we ought to define. A smurf?
A smurf, yeah. Well, it's a guy who basically is a pass-through. In a money
the cutout kind of and this is made necessary because of the complicated series of shell companies and other similar kinds of cutouts that they employed to make it more difficult to follow the money.
Absolutely. And so there's a whole bunch of emails between Walker and Hunter where Walker acknowledges receiving money from third parties, and then Hunter says, send me some. And this is all documented via Hunter's lost laptop.
Right. One of the entities from which the money was received, as I understand it, George, and there were a number of them, from all different kinds of places, none of them particularly savory, I think it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. But a Chinese energy concern is widely understood to have been basically a front for Chinese intelligence. Mm-hmm. Am I right about that? And was this one of the entities that money laundered through all of these machinations?
Yeah, this is one of the most concerning ones. Because a lot of the money that came in from Ukraine and other places was what we might refer to as garden variety corruption. But the Chinese money all has ties back to Red China's intelligence operations and their, the People's Liberation Army. So those are great potentials for compromising not only the decision making in our government, but important national security means and, you know, operations.
Yeah. And George, of course, we're having this conversation on the eve of a meeting between Joe Biden and Xi Jinping, the capo di tutti capi of this transnational criminal organization, with whom it seems the Bidens were involved in a kind of racketeering operation. You know, our friend and colleague Sam Faddis, a fellow member of our Committee on the Present Danger of China, I'm fond of pointing out, is called the relationship between these two, a handler, basically, in Xi's case, and a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party in Joe Biden's case. He's even gone so far on our air to say this meeting is kind of an asset meeting where the handler sits down and tells the controlled asset what his tasking is, what he has to go do. And so, George, I mean, you've studied this stuff fairly closely, I know, but is it fair to say that an awful lot of the things that Joe Biden has done that seem to have two things to me in common? One, they're bad for America, and two, they benefit the Chinese Communist Party. That further attests to not just the compromise, the capture of Joe through these family members and Rob Walker and so on, and that he's rendered real service in exchange for this money.
I think that Sam is exactly right. And I'd also point out that there are a lot of things that Joe Biden hasn't done that benefit the Red Chinese. And so, you know, a lot of the benefit to the Chinese in the relationship is simply Biden not acting. And so, you know,
sitting on his hands, creating yet further opportunities for the Chinese to act against our vital interests. And as I think you know, I've described Xi as an arsonist setting fires around the world. And some of that inaction, or some of the action, for that matter, is clearly benefiting the CCP. We'll talk more about that on the other side of a very short break. Stay tuned for more with the great George Raceley right after this. Welcome back. We are continuing our conversation with George Raceley, the editor-in-chief of Richard Viguerie's newsletter, Conservative HQ. And George, we set the predicate for this question in the previous block, but just to put a fine point on it, the new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson, seems to feel as though there's still not quite enough evidence to impeach or even to bring formal impeachment proceedings to bear on Joe Biden himself. Do you concur? And in light of all of this, what do you think it's going to take?
Well, there's some question whether Speaker Johnson said exactly that or meant exactly that. But it's clear that the leadership team in the House of Representatives thinks that this impeachment inquiry needs to proceed to further document the ties between the lower echelons of the Biden crime family and the big guy himself. And so, you know, I think while it's clear to people like us that follow it every day, that there's plenty of evidence that impeachable offenses were committed, it's not so clear in the sense that you can present a case as a prosecutor would and say, you know, here are the steps and here's, you know, here's the deposit slip, so to speak, in Joe's bank account for these ill-gotten funds. And so that's what they're looking for in the impeachment inquiry. And I think they'll find it if they keep digging.
Yeah, the proverbial smoking gun, as they say. Yeah,
the smoking George, check.
Yeah. Speaking of impeachment, the House failed, as I understand it, by 8 votes yesterday to begin an impeachment proceeding against the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that, George? Is there sufficient evidence to your mind that that would be in order?
Well, there's certainly sufficient evidence that he is completely incompetent, is completely conducting his office in ways that are inimical to the security of the United States. The question, I guess, is, does that meet the definition of an impeachable offense? I don't think that the 8 Republicans that joined the Democrats to knock that down were voting on the basis of some technical reading of the Constitution's definition of an impeachable offense. I think it's got a lot to do with them just being lily-livered. And there's a handful of what we used to call in the Reagan days squishes in the House Republican Conference that simply are not going to do anything to put Biden on the spot or to draw unwanted attention to their reelection efforts.
Well, this is so shocking. I look, from where I sit, you don't have to look beyond what Mayorkas has presided over with respect to the border.
Yeah, absolutely.
To say this is not just incompetence, this is not even just malfeasance, this is a betrayal of the country. And treason is one of the specified crimes for which people can and should be impeached. Well, I hope they'll get around to it and that this will not be hindered by the petty political considerations of some of the squishes in the House of Representatives. George, there's another thing afoot that I wanted to ask you about, because I think having spent some time on Capitol Hill, as you have, like me, you have a certain affection, shall we say, for the institutions up there. In the United States Senate, in the course of the day as we speak, we anticipate the Senate will approve a standing, the Senate Rules Committee, I should say, will approve on a party line vote a standing resolution, which means a precedent setting change to the Senate rules that could, go far beyond its immediate purpose. Talk a little bit about what its immediate purpose is and what the implications might be for the Senate if it adopts this resolution.
Well, the short sort of cliff note version is that they want to do away with the filibuster. And this is a backdoor way of doing it. Democrats have wanted to do away with the filibuster for a long time. What this rules change,
at least when they're in the majority, they want to do that.
Yeah. So what this rules change would allow them to do is to move without going through the necessary procedural steps, would allow them to move all these promotions that Tommy Tuberville has been holding up.
Military promotions, that
military is. But as I read it, it goes far beyond just a one-off way of getting around Tuberville's filibuster, which frankly they can do under the present rules. All they have to do is bring them up one at a time, vote for cloture, boom, the promotion goes through. Democrats are using this to essentially destroy the 250 years of precedent that the Senate has operated under. And it's shameful that they're drive to power is undermining the principles, the traditions, the rules that have ensured our democratic republic remains a free the free as we know it, should I say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. George, the thing that's troubling to me about this is I get why people in the majority would want to do this, just dispense with the filibuster to otherwise deny rights to the minority. What I just can't get is why would Republicans in the minority want any part of that? It just seems to me so against their vital interest, as well as the interest, as you say, of the United States more generally.
It's completely mind-boggling to me, Frank. But these guys are, and you know, it's not all of them, but there's enough of them who basically have no principles other than keeping their job, keeping whatever little piece of power they have, and they would gladly abandon any constitutional principle for two stoplights in their state and the opportunity for a big job on K Street when they leave office. And destroying the country.
It is. And also, I think, probably the favorable notices of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and good treatment from their Democratic colleagues. Mm-hmm. Look, and the fact that this is all being done to basically prevent Tommy Tuberville from exercising his right to have a hold on these nominations and then make them vote on each of them, mm-hmm. especially at a time, George, as we've talked about, when there are so many of these people being promoted by the Biden administration who are embracing cultural Marxism in the military. I mean, that's bad enough, but the idea that they're going to destroy the filibuster or at least weaken its application is beyond me and should be objected to by every voter in the states where these senators are residing. George, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for joining us. Come back soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.